I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The Maryland General Assembly session opens in Annapolis tomorrow, and Democrats are gearing up for a budget battle with Republican Governor-elect Larry Hogan. In Washington, President Obama and the new Republican-controlled Congress are predictably at odds over a number of issues. In this hour of Midday, we talk state and national politics with Republican blogger Richard Cross III and Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green. Plus, we hear from Maryland Senator Ben Cardin on the Republican drive to get the Keystone XL pipeline approved, and from Representative John Sarbanes about the continuing assaults on the Affordable Care Act. Midday politics after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In the second hour of our show today, we're going to hear all about the future plans for Lexington Market here in Baltimore, the oldest continuously operating public market in the country. Architect Klaus Philipson will be joining us along with the chief of the Baltimore Public Markets. That'll be in the second hour of our show. Up first, this is Midday Politics. And joining me for a conversation in Studio A are Andy Green, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, who serves as opinion editor of the newspaper, and Richard Cross III, Republican commentator and blogger at Cross Purposes. That's Richard's blog. Richard, Andy, nice to see you. Thanks for joining us
today. Great to be here.
Good to be here.
Maryland's General Assembly, the 2015 edition, starts its 90-day session tomorrow, and Democrats who dominate the legislature are bracing for a contentious session. Could be a contentious session. The Republican governor-elect Larry Hogan has warned Marylanders that budget cuts are on the way. He hasn't specified where spending will be reduced or what programs will be cut, but he has emphasized that the state's $1 billion budget shortfall is his number one priority. So we'll start off by getting a little preview of things in Annapolis from WYPR State House reporter Chris Connolly. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Hey, give us the sense of things, and what are you hearing from people as they get ready to start this next session?
Well, I think what you hear from people is just a lot of uncertainty. I mean, the big question is exactly what Larry Hogan, the incoming governor, is going to do and how he's going to govern. And then there's also a question of, you have so many new legislators coming in, about a third of the House, a quarter of the Senate are brand new. And so there's a lot of question marks, I think, right now about exactly what will happen. Everybody is anticipating that the budget will be the big thing that everybody's talking about this year. But Hogan has been very tight-lipped about exactly what his plans are with the budget. And so everybody's just been sort of waiting and guessing and theorizing about what they could expect to come.
That's the major issue, certainly. Larry Hogan has said things during the campaign, said that he wanted to slash spending, roll back some of the tax increases that occurred during the O'Malley administration. So the big question remains, can he do that? Also, he's talked about making Maryland more business-friendly. You haven't heard anything from the governor-elect about that specifically yet.
No, not specifically, but, I mean, he has taken some hot shots, not necessarily said exactly what he wants to do about it with certain environmental regulations, for example, that he sees as unfriendly to businesses or bad for business. You know, the O'Malley administration had put forward regulations on trying to limit the amount of phosphorus from chicken manure going into the bay, and he's sort of taken aim. Hogan has taken aim at that and said that he thinks that's a bad set of regulations that hurts chicken farmers, then you also have this sort of now perennial issue of the stormwater management fee, that critics call the rain tax, that is supposed to raise money to help ameliorate the effects of stormwater running off into the bay. So, I mean, some of the talk about making the state more friendly to business has also sounded to some like, wondering if the has set some people to wonder whether or not that might mean rolling back some of these environmental pieces of legislation and regulation that have come out of the last 8 years.
Well, thank you, Chris. I just wonder, have you taken a look at any pre-filed bills, or is there any other issue on the horizon for the legislature that you're looking at?
Well, I think education will be a big issue, and you've seen a lot of fight to for supporters of education spending over the last 8 years, saying, you know, don't put this now, you know, this is important. You know, Hogan hasn't said that he particularly intends to cut education, but he has said, you know, nothing is sacred. We're looking at everything. We're making evaluation. The Maryland State Educators Association, the biggest teachers union in the state, has started airing ads saying, you know, education is spending money on education is a good way to help a local state economy along. So I think, you know, we're going to see some questions around education coming up. Those bills haven't actually come in yet, but the bills are starting to roll in. They're starting to pile up, and you know, there will be a lot to sort through.
Thank you.
Pretty soon here.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris, for spending a little time with us today, and we'll look for your reports from Annapolis during the course of the 90 days.
All righty.
Thank you very much. Chris Conley, who covers the State House for WYPR. So, Richard Cross, you can go back to the time when a Republican came into office in Annapolis. It wasn't all that long ago, January 2003, I believe.
I remember it well. Yes.
Yeah, because you worked for Robert Ehrlich.
I did.
So you want to talk a little bit about that, maybe, in comparison to where we are today with Larry Hogan?
Well, I'm, subjectively speaking, I get a sense that there's more of an open-mindedness here among legislators coming in. And maybe that's because there's a lot of new legislators coming in. I think the battle lines had already started to form back in 2003 when the new governor came in, and I think that was still a kind of a surprise election to many people. So the governor thought it would be a homecoming for him being a former legislator, and the legislators themselves had a different way of thinking about it. Whereas now I think they have that previous experiment kind of in their minds, and you have so many new faces and people who have not been in Annapolis before that there's a general open-mindedness.
Did Ehrlich, refresh your memory, did Robert Ehrlich make statements such as, you know, I want to work with the legislature, things like that, on his way into Annapolis?
In the inaugural speech he did, yeah. And I think there was a general sense of course I'll work with the legislature because I know all those guys, I know all those people, and that's just the way it works down there. But I don't think he really went out of his way to kind of hammer the case. He just assumed people would know it.
Andy Green, so Larry Hogan coming in here takes a look at the state budget and the expectations for revenue or revenue shortfall for the state, and he says, this looks a lot worse than I thought it was going to be, so Marylanders have to prepare for the worst.
Right,
so
our revenue estimates have been coming in lower than expected. Maryland's economy has not, at least seemingly, is not bouncing back in the way that the national economy has been, probably largely to do with cutbacks in federal spending, which disproportionately affect us. You see the same thing going on in Virginia, which has the same problem. So the budget gap depends on how you count it. It's probably like around $750 million for the fiscal 2016 budget, which is the one that he has to put in a proposal for 2 days after he's inaugurated. Now, a governor and general assembly can paper over $750 million in about 10 minutes if they want to. They have lots of experience doing this. They've been doing it for years. They've been doing it with much worse numbers than this for most of the last 5 or 6 years. The difference here is that Larry Hogan is saying, look, I don't want to do business that way. I want to realistically align our revenues and our spending, and you know, God bless him for it. Let's see if we can actually do this. It'll be difficult for a couple of reasons. You know, for one thing, some of the tools that O'Malley and the legislature have used are effectively not available to Larry Hogan. One, we passed this constitutional amendment that makes it more difficult to borrow money from the Transportation Trust Fund. And two, some of the tactics that O'Malley used, like borrowing from open space and backfilling that with capital debt, are no longer practically available simply because our debt has gotten too high. We can't really continue along that path. So there are some real practical reasons why you can't do it. He also philosophically says, I want to, you know, make this alignment. The difficulty for him is going to be that 80-some percent of the budget is basically locked up in formula-driven spending. You know, for example, education spending is all formula-driven. It's a matter of number of pupils, poverty rates, all kinds of things like that. Basically spits out a figure, here's what you're supposed to put into the schools. You know, same thing for, say, community colleges, Medicaid. You know, a huge percentage of budget is formula-driven. And so although Larry Hogan, as Maryland's governor, will have tremendous power to set spending priorities for the state. He can't monkey with that stuff unless he gets the legislature to go along with him. And he's going to really need to, you can't really solve this problem in that 19% slice of discretionary spending. You need to get at some of these formulas in order to recalibrate things. So that's where the debate is going to lie. Now, the second question is, he has said he plans to include tax cuts in his first proposal, which makes sense for him politically. Obviously, he campaigned on that issue, and I could see why he wants to keep faith with the voters. But as he says, the numbers are coming in worse than he expected. He faces a big fight, and I think it's going to be a more difficult fight with the Democratic General Assembly if he's saying, look, we need to cut these spending formulas that people have worked for years and years to create and maintain, and at the same time also cut taxes. I think he's going to have a hard time with that.
Can either of you or both of you comment on the cabinet that he's put together and what kind of signals you pick up from Larry Hogan in that regard in terms of the way he might govern?
Well, I think it's a good mix of new people and people from the Ehrlich administration. I think the person he picked to lead DBED has shown a lot of experience. Mike Gill, I believe his name is.
Business and Economic Development.
Yes. Yeah.
I was also particularly pleased to see him retain Sam Abed, who's the Juvenile Services Secretary from the O'Malley administration. He has really impressed me since he's come into the state. He made, for example, some policy and management decisions that basically obviated the need to build that youth jail in Baltimore City.
The juvie jail,
which had become a huge issue fiscally and in terms of criminal justice policy. That agency has been troubled for a long time, and you haven't been hearing a lot about it lately, and that's a good thing.
We were just talking about Sam Abed, having him on the show next week, where we're going to focus an hour on juvenile justice in the country and in Maryland.
I would say one more. I've always been an advocate of the party, or the Republican Party, giving women opportunities to advance, so I was very happy to see Delegate Kelly Schultz was named ahead of Dollar.
Could you take a quick look for us at the new legislature? I mean, Chris mentioned about these changes, and you've mentioned the new legislators coming in here. Quite a lot of changes.
Definitely. I mean, coming from my home county, Baltimore County, Dundalk, which has been historically Democratic area, is now solidly Republican, which is something that many of us who lived in Baltimore County never thought we would see. So that really is kind of signals a sea change, I think, at least in Baltimore County. And I think you'll see similar changes across the state.
But the numbers are still there for the Democrats.
They are still there. They still have veto-proof majorities in the House and Senate, albeit not as wide of ones as they enjoyed during the Ehrlich years. They'll have to work out it a little harder if they want to go back to this veto override game they played with Governor Ehrlich. There have been some losses among experienced Democrats. Norm Conway, who is the head of the Appropriations Committee in the House, lost. In general, though, what you're seeing is, as Richard said, there have been a number of Republicans who have come in, particularly in Baltimore County. They had a big surge in Republicans, but some other places, too. And what they have done is they're, of course, not knocking out the most progressive Democrats. They're knocking out the most conservative Democrats. And so you've got this situation where, although the number of Republicans in the House and the Senate has increased, those bodies are at least as progressive and possibly more so in their overall orientation than they were before.
And in terms of the leadership in the Senate and in the House, you have, of course, Mike Miller, Senator Mike Miller, the Senate President, over in that side, and Mike Bush in the House side. In terms of their relationship with Larry Hogan, what do you foresee there? Richard, what do you see?
Well, Larry Hogan has strong PG County roots, so he has a history with Mike Miller, and I think he kind of goes in there with a good personal relationship on that level. I'm not sure what his relationship is like with Mike Bush, but the Mike Miller-Larry Hogan relationship is going to be interesting to watch unfold.
Yeah, and they probably have a lot of affinity on a lot of issues, too, right? Because Mike Miller is hardly a liberal Democrat.
Yeah, also Larry Hogan's job in the Ehrlich administration was the appointment secretary, and a big part of that job is getting the governor's nominees through the Senate. So he has put in some time with Mike Miller over the years. And there was only one appointee from the Ehrlich administration did not get confirmed by the Senate.
Lynn Buell.
Right. Yeah, the environmental secretary nominee. So there's a relationship there. Mike Bush and Larry Hogan, they know each other, obviously. So far, so good. I don't get the sense as Richard said earlier, I don't get the sense that people are loaded for bear just yet. That may take, you know, a week or two to develop.
Yeah. Andy Green is opinion editor of the Baltimore Sun. Richard Cross, a Republican blogger at Cross Purposes. So we'll talk about state politics in this hour of the show, as well as national politics. When we get back, we're going to be speaking with Senator Ben Cardin about the atmosphere in Washington, and specifically about the future of the Keystone XL pipeline that Republicans are pushing. We now have Democratic President Obama, of course, now facing a Republican-controlled both houses of Congress. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday if you'd like to join our conversation here. It's Midday Politics. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It's Midday Politics. Dan Roderick's here with Andy Green from the Baltimore Sun, the opinion editor there, and a Republican blogger and commentator, Richard Cross III. We're joined now by Senator Ben Cardin from Washington. Senator, thanks for joining us on the show again.
Dan, it's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah. Well, we have a new Congress and the same president, the Democratic president, now both houses controlled by Republicans. So, first of all, just a sample the atmosphere through you a little bit in terms of Washington in the last couple of weeks.
Well, I think there really is a sense here that we want to try to get things done. So there's been a lot of conversations among Democrats and Republicans. We understand we have divided government. Yes, the Congress is controlled by Republicans, both the House and the Senate. In the Senate, it's difficult to get work done without a 60-vote threshold. And, of course, the White House is still President Obama. So it's important for Democrats and Republicans to work together. That means compromise. You don't compromise your principles, but you figure out ways to move this country forward. So I think that's the attitude here. This week in Baltimore, the Democratic senators will be meeting. President Obama will be with us on Thursday. So I think it's a chance for us to try to develop a way in which we can advance our principles to try to help working families, middle class, create more jobs, let people be able to have the opportunities of advancing through the economic ladder of success, how we can do that, and work with a Republican majority in both the House and Senate.
The Senate voted 63-32 on Monday to take up the XL pipeline project, that bill, to approve the project. The president, of course, has vowed a veto there. I wanted to hear from you on this because you voted against it before.
Well, I think it's unfortunate that this is the first major issue that the new Republican leadership in the Senate has decided to move forward. It will not help our energy policy. We're talking about the dirtiest tar sand oils that are generally mined through a strip mining process that is damaging to our environment, being shipped through the United States to a tax-free port in the Gulf of Mexico and going into the international marketplace. So it does very little to help our energy supply, creates virtually no permanent jobs. Less than 50 permanent jobs are created through the pipeline. And it's certainly a challenge for our environment, not just the use of this oil directly, but the way that it deals with the U.S. leadership and climate change. So for all those reasons, I think it's unfortunate this is the first major issue to come before the United States Senate.
So, Senator Andy Green here, do you get the sense that this was something the Republicans needed to get out of their system, given how much it was discussed during the campaign, that we're going to take up a few issues like this, you know, for example, the Keystone Pipeline, some of the nibbling at the edges of the Affordable Care Act that you see going on in the House right now, and then we could perhaps move on to other things, or is this the way it's going to be for the next 2 years?
Well, I hope it's what you said first. I hope this is a view that the Republicans had to bring this up. They made a commitment to do that in regards to what happened with the lame duck session, the elections in Louisiana, that this was a commitment that had been given to bring this issue up. Leader Mitch McConnell can allow the amendment process to move forward on this bill because the stakes aren't very high since the bill is going to be vetoed by the president. We clearly have the support in Congress to sustain a veto. So it's, I think, probably more symbolic than a real test, and I hope that we can then go on to try to get things done collectively. Andy, it's interesting this afternoon, or tomorrow, I believe, there's going to be meetings of the Senate Finance Committee, the Democrats and Republicans, in an effort to try to work together on some tax reform issues. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a lot going on to try to move forward and see what we can get done for this country.
Some comments about Keystone from our listeners, Senator, and Andy and Richard. David says, Keystone is a litmus test. If it is authentically approved, the country is lost, either through ignorance or corruption, and most likely both. Greg says Keystone does next to nothing that benefits the U.S. The environmental hazards from the pipeline are simply not worth the risk. I know extraction is going to happen and we have no control over it, but we should absolutely refuse to transport this toxic sludge across our country. Just one thing about that. Another listener wrote to me this morning, knowing that we were going to ask you about this today, Senator, and pointed out that there are millions of miles of pipelines already in existence in the United States. So in the environmental count, that's one of the points that you make here. What is your opposition there? Is it you worried about leakage from the pipes if this thing goes through?
Well, it is correct. We have existing pipelines that could be used. They're not as efficient as the pipeline that they're intending to construct. And I will disagree with that this is going to happen anyway. The extraction process is not inexpensive. As I said, it's a strip mining process. This is not where you put a pipe in the ground and the oil comes to the surface. This you actually have to go mine for because it's so thick and dirty. So the economics of oil today, with the price of gasoline at the pump being what it is, and the price of oil per barrel being at a recent low, the economics of extracting and transporting this tar sand oil could very well prevent it from being done if this pipeline is not constructed. So I think there isn't the economics here that we would be facilitating to allow dirty oil to get to the market that can hurt our efforts to deal with climate change. My major reason for opposing it is that the Canadians don't want it going through their country to the port. They want it coming through our country because if there's a spill, it's very difficult to clean up the spill. We had a spill in Michigan, we had a spill in Arkansas, and the damage was almost just about permanent. It takes a long time to clean up this type of oil spill. So there is a spill issue concern, but I think my principal reason for objecting is it does very little for our energy policy, and the environmental risk to the United States and globally is just not worth making it easier for this type of oil to get to the marketplace.
Senator, here's Richard Cross.
Senator, we were talking about the need for bipartisan cooperation now in Annapolis, which is not something that's typically used to. I was wondering, now that the Senate is under Republican control, if you could speak to the tone within the Democratic conference as to whether or not Democrats see an opportunity, or they are optimistic about talking to Republicans and reaching consensus, and maybe not this issue, but other issues?
Well, it depends on the issue. I think the first major challenge will be the budget issues, how the Republicans use the power they have on what's known as reconciliation, where they can pass issues with a simple majority, how they use that. If they use it as an effort to move forward on a bipartisan budget that allows for some tax reform, that allows us to put some more resources into infrastructure improvement in this country, create more jobs, I think Democrats are going to be willing to sit down and say, okay, we know we can't get our way, but let's work together so we can get at least progress made on job growth, on improving our roads, our infrastructure in this country, and making our tax code fairer than it is today. So there is at least that discussions that are taking place. On the other hand, if they follow what they did on Keystone with a repeal of the Affordable Care Act and they start doing non-starters for Democrats, then it's going to be a long 2 years.
I'd like to follow that up with a question about Maryland's congressional delegation. Obviously, the results of the election had consequences for Democrats, but it also had consequences for Democrats in Maryland. Senator Mikulski lost her chairmanship. Congressman Ruppersberger has since rotated off the Intelligence Committee. What challenges do you see the delegation facing, and how do you view your ability to overcome them?
Well, I am proud of the Maryland congressional delegation. I think we have been very effective in representing the needs of the people of Maryland in Congress. Senator Mikulski is a fierce competitor, and will continue to be a fierce competitor in the United States Senate. She will have incredible impact on the appropriation process. No, she won't have the gavel, but she'll, as the ranking Democrat on the committee, recognizing that these bills only pass when there is cooperation between the House, between the Democrats and Republicans, Senator Mikulski will be in a key position on appropriation issues. I'm taking on the lead Democrat on small business in this Congress. I did not have that position in the last. That will give me an opportunity to weigh in on trying to help a lot of Maryland companies, particularly those who have procurement or contracts with the government, as to how we can improve economic growth in our state, how we can build on the biotech industries, the cybersecurity industries, our relationship with the Department of Defense, all those areas we think we can improve upon during these next 2 years. In the House side, Steny Hoyer, of course, is in a key position and has had an incredible impact on so many different issues. Our local delegation, Elijah Cummings, is a key player. John Sarbanes, Dutch Ruppersberger, they all are going to play very important roles in this Congress. So I think our delegation is well positioned. We'd be better if we were in the majority for the Democrats, absolutely. But we're well positioned to represent the people of Maryland.
Senator, do you have time for a question from one of our listeners?
Sure, absolutely.
This is Don in Annapolis. You're on Midday Don with Senator Cardin. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Dan. Senator Cardin, thank you for taking my call. And I was just wondering whether you said there were only 50 jobs to be created by the pipeline. How many jobs would be created for union pipe fitters and boilermakers in constructing the pipeline, number one? And number two is, you called it dirty oil. Is there anything that you would call clean oil?
Well, there are different types of oils. And yes, there are oils that are better burning, but you're correct. All of them have a carbon footprint, which, quite frankly, we're better off with clean energy. We're better off with renewable and alternative energy sources than we are from fossil fuel sources. But there are certain fossil fuels that burn cleaner and they're easier to extract than others. And tar sand oil is at the bottom of the chain as far as the damage to our environment in extracting it and the amount of carbon that it emits in its use. So it's among choices, that's something that we would prefer not to have to rely on. There are construction jobs that are created by the pipeline. There's no question about it. These are temporary jobs, but they're important jobs. I would submit that we could create a lot more jobs by working on a transportation bill that would not only provide the construction jobs, but give us a modern infrastructure that we desperately need in this country in our roads, our bridges, and our transit systems. We could do the same with an energy grid. We could do the same with our water infrastructure. There's a lot of infrastructure projects that will create more construction jobs for the amount of money that's invested and has a much better impact on our future economic growth than another pipeline.
Hey, one last question, Senator. Looking at the year ahead here, are there any issues that you're worried about, any further attacks by Republicans on, some of the key policy choices the president has made over the years, accomplishments the president has made over the years, laws that have passed? I'm looking at Dodd-Frank and wondering about that, the Environmental Protection Agency. Are you worried about some of these things?
Dan, there's a lot of things that I think are vulnerable, but let me say, as a senator from Maryland, two areas of particular concern that I'll be watching very closely. One is the Chesapeake Bay and the impact that the Republican attack on the Environmental Protection Agency could have on our game plan for trying to improve the Chesapeake Bay for future generations. There's a lot of attacks going on, a lot of environmental riders that passed the House in the last Congress that we stopped in the Senate that deal with clean water that could very well be in jeopardy in this Congress. Now, we always had the backstop of the presidential veto, but if it's included in bills that are must-pass bills, it becomes very challenging to have to just rely on the president. So that's a matter of major concern. The second is the area of our federal workforce and the governmental sector. We've seen the Republicans have an all-out assault on our federal workforce That's the work they do is critically important to our country. They're the ones at NIH that do the cutting edge research. They're the people at FDA to keep our food safe, the people at the Social Security Administration to make sure that we get our Social Security checks and deal with the Medicare system. All those are important responsibilities. And the Republicans have shown in the past a willingness to put the federal workforce at risk. So there are two areas that are going to be particularly of concern to me as a senator from Maryland. But you're absolutely correct on Dodd-Frank. There's already been assaults on the protections to the public that we passed in Dodd-Frank on the financial services. So that's an area of particular concern also.
Senator Cardin, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Good talking to you, Dan.
Yep.
Talk
Senator
to you
Ben
nice
Cardin,
talk.
Maryland. So, Andy, so what did you think about what he had to say, or in terms of
the other thing of here about the prospects for cooperation is that the 2016 presidential election is basically already underway.
Yeah.
You know, Mitt Romney is saying he's going to run, so you know, a lot of us were really on tenterhooks about that. But, you know, you see, you know, you've got Marco Rubio already gearing up in the Senate. You know, there's a lot of people in the Republican field who are going to who are either, you know, in government or going to be affecting what goes on that I think you may that's likely to impede the chances of any kind of cooperation because there's going to be a lot of jockeying to try to position the party in advance of that election, given the Republicans dry streak of the last couple of elections on the federal level.
Richard Krause, what do you think of Mitt Romney the third time around?
I'm not sure I quite yet believe it. You know, Friday it came out that he had made this comment to one of his donors. Now all of a sudden he's recruiting staff.
Yeah.
Obviously he did it to not allow Governor Bush, former Governor Bush in Florida, to get an early lead on some of the money that they're going to be competing for. I'm not yet sure that he's going to pull the trigger.
Okay. We'll take a break here. You're welcome to join us as Midday Politics. Dan Roderick's joined by Richard Krause, Republican blogger at Krause Purposes. That's the name of his blog. And Andy Green, opinion editor of the Baltimore Sun. When we get back, we'll hear from a member of the Maryland delegation to the Congress in the House of Representatives. John Sarbanes will be joining us to talk about things in Washington, specifically an attempt to change an aspect of the Affordable Care Act as Republicans continue their attack on the ACA. 410-662-8780. What do you think about Mitt Romney running for president a third time? Or anything else you'd like to talk about, state, national politics? We'll cover it all in this hour of the show. 410-662-8780.
Coming up in Midday's second hour, once a thriving destination for tourists and locals alike, Baltimore's Lexington Market has been dragged down in recent years by a reputation for drugs and crime. But big changes are ahead. City planners are preparing for a multi-million dollar overhaul. Hear about the plans in the second hour of Midday, after the news at 1.
By the way, Larry Hogan takes the oath of office as Maryland's next governor next week.
Yes.
The legislature begins tomorrow.
Correct.
Hogan takes office next week.
Next Wednesday.
And then when does the State of the State address occur? When does he give his first speech to the legislature?
That's not for another couple of weeks.
February 4th.
Yeah.
February 4th. Okay. That's when we probably hear more details about what he has in mind in terms of the budget and
right.
his priorities.
Although he'll introduce his budget on the – he's required to introduce it on the 23rd, which is 2 days after inauguration.
Okay. So you get a look at some of his proposals.
Yeah. We'll be able to divine – you know, obviously the budget is the big one, so we'll know – where he is trying to cut. And also, he will presumably have to include what is known as a BRFA, the Budget Financing and Reconciliation Act, a big deal in Annapolis. So this is where there are all of these laws that say you have to spend X amount of money on this, you have to spend X amount of money on that. And so every year the governor puts in the second bill that says, never mind those laws. Here's what we're going to do. So this is the bill that's that fixes all of the other laws to make the budget legal.
I get it. All right. Thank you, Andy. That's Andy Green, opinion editor of the Baltimore Sun and GOP commentator and blogger Richard Krause III with us in the studio, joined by phone now by John Sarbanes, Congressman Sarbanes. Thanks for joining us again on Midday.
Dan, how you doing?
Good. The question is, how are you doing? let's see. We still have a Democratic president, now a Republican-controlled Senate as well as a House.
Right.
How are you feeling about this? Do you think this is going to be a do-something Congress?
Well, we'll see. We start these new sessions of Congress with optimism on that score, and we'll see if we can get some things done collaboratively. Obviously, the president has an idea of some things he wants to get accomplished, and so does the Republican leadership here in the House and the Senate. So we'll see if we can find common ground going forward. But I think in order to be a responsible member of the House of Representatives or the Senate, you need to start off at least right at the beginning of each new session, believing that something constructive can get done.
Tell us about the Affordable Care Act. Let's talk about this a little bit. We keep hearing about it. There's another test of it coming up in the Supreme Court, I think, in early March. But in the Congress already, there's a proposal to change an element of the law that has to do with the definition of a full-time worker, a full-time work week.
Right.
Let's talk about this a little bit.
Well, there's sort of two universes where the health care, the Affordable Care Act, is playing out. One is sort of out in the real world where I think it's really getting positive traction in terms of providing more coverage to people. You've seen the number of uninsured adults decline significantly over the last year as a result of the ACA. Over 10 million uninsured Americans have gotten coverage under ACA. And there's a lot of other positive things that I could point to. So that's what's kind of happening out there with the ACA. And Maryland's performance with the health exchange this time around was very positive compared with the initial rollout last year. But then you have another world, kind of the legislative proposal world here in Washington, where I think it remains largely the agenda of the Republican majority to kind of achieve a death by a thousand cuts with respect to the health care bill. And the latest example of that was trying to adjust the definition of full-time employment under the ACA from 30 hours to 40 hours. And to explain this, right now, it says that if an employer that has more than 50 employees, that employer has to provide health care coverage to any employee that is full-time, and that's defined as 30 hours or more. So there has been a situation where some employers have kind of gamed the system around that break point between 30 and 29 and, you know, reduced people's hours to 29, then they avoid the obligation of either coverage or paying into the system. So the Republican leadership came along and said, oh, this is terrible. People are losing coverage at that 30-29 break point, so let's move it up and redefine it at 40 hours. But what they're not telling you is actually there's a lot more people clustered around the 40-hour, 39-hour break point. And if you think about it, Dan, that's intuitive to, mm-hmm, I think most people, that there'd be a lot of folks at that definitional point. So it actually would allow employers to game the system more by dropping people to 39 and avoiding that coverage obligation, and that would mean more people losing coverage. So I voted against that because I thought it was a bad idea, but it's just an example of coming along and sort of pulling on these threads of the health care bill, hoping over time to just kind of unravel the thing. I don't think President Obama is going to let that happen.
So, Congressman, why do you think they took this approach of recalibrating the number of hours for the work week as opposed to just going after the employer mandate in general? I mean, I think you would find a lot more support among health policy people to say, like, look, the employer mandate is not necessary to make this whole thing work, but monkeying with the 30 versus 40 just exacerbates the problem they're supposedly fixing.
And it's, let me just add before John Sarbanes' response that it's not necessary because people can go into an exchange and find insurance on their own without the employer. That's what you mean, right, John Sarbanes?
I think it's because it can kind of be presented as sort of a technical change or a technical correction. So it's sort of you're starting this process of nicking away at the health care bill in the new session. You're kind of starting it by making it look like you're just doing some little things, some adjustments. But the problem is over time, there's an aggregate impact that comes from these things, which really begin to undermine the structure of the health care bill in terms of the way it was set up. And it's been very carefully calibrated so that it will actually work. And so I think it's part of a strategy where it looks kind of like a small technical change on the front end, but by the time you're finished this process and you add other things into the mix, you've really jeopardized the ability of the healthcare reform to function in a positive way.
The disconnect for me, or cognitive dissonance in all of this, is as more people who didn't have insurance get insurance, or people who were underinsured get better insurance. There's millions of people now in this category, many of them represented by Republican congressmen who opposed the ACA and voted every opportunity to repeal it. And I just wonder, looking at it from a common sense point of view, how much longer this goes on politically for Republicans. How much more can they gain? They sort of have made their point, haven't they, by voting for repeal so many times?
I would think that they sort of made and exhausted their point by now, Dan, with respect to the ACA. And I think your point is well taken. I think as increasing numbers of people in this country benefit from this reform and actually connect it to the reform. I mean, part of the problem is, you know, sometimes people run into trouble in their healthcare world and they blame the ACA for that when actually the ACA doesn't have anything to do with it. By the same token, sometimes they're benefiting from the ACA, but they don't realize that that's why it's happening. So as people begin to, I think, connect the progress they're making in terms of being able to access affordable, high-quality healthcare coverage going forward and attribute that to the ACA, I think it gains traction, and I think politically it becomes less attractive for the Republicans to target it.
Before I go to Richard Cross for his comment on this, I don't want to let Democrats off the hook on this, because I don't think Democrats have made this point enough to the American people about the benefits of it. In fact, in this last campaign, a lot of Democratic candidates ran the other way or wouldn't even mention the ACA, certainly not use the term Obamacare in any positive way that I could see.
We can deliver, obviously, always you can do a better job of delivering a unified, compelling narrative around the positive aspects of this kind of reform. The problem is it's often easier to attack something than it is to promote it. That's not an excuse. That's an explanation for why it's hard, and we'll just have to keep letting people know what the good news is around the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I have a question and a comment. The comment first, it's my perception that in terms of the last elections, the Affordable Care Act didn't play quite the role as it did, say, 2 years prior. So that might be evidence that this strategy is kind of petering out. Now, Congressman, you had mentioned a strategy of kind of pulling on the strings of the law. Given that you're an expert in healthcare policy and looking ahead for the next 2 years, which other tactics would you anticipate they may yet try before this backlash against the law ceases?
Well, there's things, for example, like the medical device tax, which I'm almost certain will bring up again, the repeal of that. The reason that's consequential is because that tax yields, and by the way, the projections show that that's something the industry can absorb pretty well, but it would yield $30 billion in revenue over the next 10 years, which is part of the funding needed to make the rest of the Affordable Care Act work. So if you pull that away, that's an example. You start pulling some of the funding foundation away from the Affordable Care Act, then it you know, obviously imperils it or jeopardizes it over time. So that I think that could be a tactic that you see, not just with respect to that specific thing, but others that they may think of. I agree. I think in the last election cycle, you saw a number of Republicans who decided this is not the fight to wage, and I hope that they'll recognize politically that that's the case going forward. I think there's other things we need to be saying in addition to the Affordable Care Act is a good thing, talking to the American people about the sort of baseline issue of getting their voice heard in Washington in ways that they feel confident that they're being represented and they have a consequential impact on what happens here. And many Americans feel like Washington is kind of an insider's game and they can't be heard. and we need to do something to address that cynicism.
So sort of along those same lines, I think a lot of Dan's listeners probably know that you have been advocating for a system of kind of partial public campaign financing, a matching system, and that you attempt to do a little bit of leading by example in this election.
Right.
So tell the listeners a little bit about what you did and what the reaction to that has been among your fellow congressmen.
I wanted to model what it would look like if a member of Congress built the funding of their campaign around everyday citizens and collecting small donations. So we picked 100 precincts across the 3rd District and tried to build sort of a matching system in those precincts where I had the incentive to go find small donors and then earn matching funds that had been donated to my campaign. The result of that was I was spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to reach everyday citizens, how to bring their voice into my campaign. And I think many of my colleagues are interested in this model, and if we had a publicly financed small donor matching system, that would really begin to empower everyday citizens out there to feel like their voice is being heard in Washington. It's practical, it's doable, and it's empowering, which is the critical thing here. I'm very, you were just talking, I heard you at the tail end of the last segment, you were talking about, here we go with the next horse race, the 2016 presidential primaries on either side, who's the next big thing? I'm more interested in the idea that maybe the next big thing in politics isn't a person, maybe it's an idea, and maybe it's the idea that people can take their government back from special interests and big money, and the way you do that is you stand up a system that rewards candidates for turning in the direction of the small donors and earning their respect and their support. We can do this, and at the end of the day, that's the one thing that can address the deep cynicism that people have out
there. Can you get it made into law?
We're not going to do it in this Congress, Dan, but the kind of support we're seeing in the polling data from across the political spectrum, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, who say, yeah, we want to own our government again, instead of special interests calling the shots in Washington, we want to be the ones that call the shots. Well, to do that, you got to make yourself the source of funding for campaigns. And that's what a hybrid system that collects small donations and then supports it with multiple matching funds is all about. It would mean, Dan, that I'd have an incentive as a candidate and a member of Congress to go stand in your living room with 30 of your friends who've made small donations that can earn matching funds instead of spending my time at a K Street fundraiser. And that will dramatically change the relationship of the electorate to their government and make people feel empowered again. I think one of the reasons we had such a low turnout in this midterm, and it was the lowest since 1942, is a lot of rational voters said, what difference does it make if I go to the polls? If the person I elect gets to Washington, starts playing the insider game, and gets captured by the special interest. So if we want to address the cynicism that's resulting in these low turnouts, we have to empower everyday citizens to be in charge. That's what that kind of reform can do. And I think ultimately we can get it passed.
Well, one of the things I like about it is it provides the opportunity for someone who may not even think about running for office, including your seat, John Sarbanes, or anybody else's seat, as a way to get in, a way to raise some money and get some matching money.
Up. Yeah. It would shake things up, and you've seen that in places where this has been implemented. You're getting a lot more diversity of candidates coming into the mix, competing and winning and going and serving their constituents.
Last time you were on the show to talk about that, our listeners wrote in, wanted to know more about it. The official name of that legislation is what?
It's the Government by the People Act. Reintroduced it. It's H.R. 20. We're collecting co-sponsors. We hope to be back up in the 150 range in terms of number of co-sponsors supporting that bill. And we're going to keep pushing this forward.
Thank you very much for being with us again today. And good luck with that, Congressman John Sarbanes.
Thanks, Dan. Take care.
Thank you. And thanks to Andy Green for being here today, opinion editor of the Baltimore Sun, baltimoresun.com. And Richard Cross III, read his musings on the Republican politics in Maryland in particular at Cross Purposes. Just Google Cross Purposes and you'll find Richard's blog. Thanks for being here again, Richard.
Thank you.
We'll catch up with you again as the legislature opens and moves along.
Sounds good.
And we watch the new governor and his dealings with the Democrats in Annapolis. Thank you, Andy.
Always a pleasure, Dan.
Please help yourself to lunch. It's provided today by Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, sandwiches, pastas, salads, all made fresh daily. Bagby Pizza is open daily, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., with delivery 5 to 9 p.m.
There's another hour of midday yet to come here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Then stay tuned to 2 for Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. What's it like to grow up in a refugee camp? We'll meet a young boy living in a camp in Jordan after escaping the war in Syria.
So he said that there he used to go to school. Here, he works, and he's not as happy as he used to be back home.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
You can hear Here and Now this afternoon at 2. Be sure to stay tuned at 3 for Fresh Air, and then at 4 for All Things Considered. And coming our way at 6:30, business news on Marketplace.
Fracking requires water, that much you've heard. Also, though, tons of sand. Not, however, just any sand.
You know, people think of sand, and you go to the beach, and you pick it up, and it's, you go to Saudi Arabia, there's a lot of sand. Well, sand's different. It's only in a couple of places.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the $10 billion sand business, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Catch Marketplace at 6:30 this evening. Stay tuned tonight at 7 for PRI's The World, and tonight at 8 for On Point. And coming our way next week...
Why do we feel fear? About a place? Or a person? Or a snake?
Oh, they're just slimy and they just sneak up on you.
And what happens when we try to control our fear?
I didn't know how to get out. I didn't know how to get out of this fear.
I'm Lulu Miller.
And I'm Elise Spiegel. And on the next episode of Invisibilia, we ask, can we disappear our fear? Invisibilia from NPR.
Invisibilia. Monday night at 8, here on your public radio, WYPR. I want to say that with an extra syllable, Invisibilia, but I think it's just Invisibilia. Anyway, you're listening to your public radio, WYPR and WYPR HD1 Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, WYPO Ocean City, and online, WYPR.org, your NPR news station. It's 1 o'clock.
For decades, a destination for tourists and locals alike, Lexington Market has seen better days. It's still a busy place, but the customer base has declined. So have the number of vendors selling fresh produce, meat, and baked goods. In recent years, Baltimore's oldest and largest public market has become associated with drug deals and crime. But that could change in coming years as city planners prepare for a multi-million dollar market overhaul, now in its initial stages. What changes are being considered? And can planners strike a balance between attracting affluent clients while serving the market's traditional customer base? Baltimore Public Markets Chief Robert Thomas and architect Klaus Philipson on Lexington Market's past, present, and future on Midday after the news.